Hi, this is Nyetta.
Hi, this is Sin.
And welcome to
The Help Show.
Hello again, welcome back to The Help Show. For our Silent Series Part 3, we would like to introduce Ms. Tiffany Lindley, Clinical Director of various youth advocate programs. In reference to our topic, suicide, she advocates self-evaluation, possible treatments and therapy, how to reach out for support, as well as support those in need, over a very informative lunch discussion.
Hi, this is Nyetta with The Help Show. I'm with Tiffany Lindley, licensed professional counselor. Hi, how you doing? Introduce yourself, Tiffany.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Lindley. I'm a licensed professional counselor. I also have a master's in developmental psychology. Currently, I'm a clinical director for a nonprofit. I also moonlight as a counselor inpatient with adolescents and children. And then I'm an independent contractor with an organization called Zoom Counseling. So, wear a lot of hats.
I like that, Tiffany. Well, we're going to get started with this session. Thank you so much for coming out. I really appreciate you. So basically, this podcast is about suicide. And a dear friend of mine named Layden Andrew committed suicide not even 45 days ago.
I'm sorry.
So this is really close to home for me. I have a couple questions I would like to ask you. The first question would be, how do you work through your own issues of wanting to commit suicide?
Well, we call it suicide ideation in the field. And basically, we look at it as a crisis situation, but it's a symptom of usually a number of symptoms. And suicide ideation is directly linked with depression. And depression is a biochemical disorder that also affects you emotionally, where your brain basically doesn't keep the neurotransmitters that make you feel good. And so, like, for example, the medications that people are on for depression, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs for short, basically they keep that good feeling, that calming neurotransmitter in your body, which is called serotonin. And so we don't have enough. It's hard to find enjoyment in the things that you love. It's hard to be motivated to do the things you want to do. You lose hope. And it makes you tired. It makes your body. With yourself, it's number one, admitting that you actually feel this way. And you don't want to deal with it on your own. Like, maybe if you've been through treatment before, you have a plan. Usually, if you go through treatment, a counselor's going to give you a crisis safety plan. So these are the signs of when I'm feeling suicidal again. These are the things I can do in the moment and for maintenance to keep myself from getting down to that dark place. Get help. Get help. Wash your dishes.
So how do you keep people with therapy? How do you help people with therapy? I'm sorry.
Okay, so what we're trained to do as counselors, therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, we all have different roles. As a master's level counselor, we start with a treatment plan. We have to know, what are we helping you with? Because we're taught so many different things and so many different techniques, but every client is unique. Everybody doesn't need the same stuff. We look at your needs and we look at your strengths. So that's just one option of treatment. We also have medication, which is effective, but medication and therapy together is the most effective treatment you can get. It almost doubles your success rate if you do both. Whether it's temporarily, you know, you have a counselor for 3 months is typically what insurance will cover, to, you know, having a counselor on call.
Okay.
You know, you can have someone that you see when you're having those stressful months and, okay, you do about 4 sessions or 6 sessions just to kind of refresh you on the skills that you've learned. There's support groups, which are usually free, not necessarily are going to be led by a professional. Could be peer groups, which means people that are going through the same thing. Not quite like an AA, which is more a leader, and then peers. A peer support group is really like, hey, we're all going through grief together. Let's find somebody to lead this group, and we're just going to talk out. We're going to have a topic. Whereas a group led by a professional is going to have, you know, some type of curriculum or some type of topic, and they're going to be documenting everybody's response. A support group is more open, not as structured, we'll say. So there's a lot of different treatment options. But like I said, for counselors, we have a plan, we execute the plan, we look at the goals, and, you know, if you reach the goals, then great. If you don't, we'll keep finding another way to get there. Just depending on their style, you know, some people give you homework with, like, paper, and you're tracking your behavior, you're tracking tracking, you know, your triggers. I'm more of a behavioral homework person. I'll give you something to do, and either you report you did it or not. And if you don't do it, why didn't you do it? And, you know, holding that person accountable for their own behavioral change.
For example, so what?
What's a homework assignment?
Yeah, what's a homework assignment?
Well, I actually had two clients this week, two sisters that are having more than typical sibling rivalry, sibling conflict. And so I gave them, okay, what do you think you need to do in the next week to show some behavioral change so you can not be the person that everyone thinks you are? Well, one was like, okay, I'll stop snitching. I'll stop telling on my sister every time. I was like, your word's not mine. I'll stop telling on my sister. I was like, if it's not important and it's not urgent and it's not dangerous, do you really need to tell?
Okay.
And she's like, that's true. Okay, yeah, she's talked to a boy 3 weeks ago, but if she's not doing anything now.
So what homework would you give to someone with suicidal?
Okay, someone who's depressed.
Someone's depressed, suicidal. What homework would you give to them?
Okay, well, again, if they're coming in at a crisis state, like when I work at the hospital, you know, they're inpatient, they're not going anywhere. So our goals usually are, you know, report not having suicide for so many days. Report that their mood has increased because usually they're being put on medication. But maybe if they came into my outpatient and they've already gone through, you know, the worst of it, something that I would give someone is maybe, hey, over the next week, can you write down the thoughts that are going through your head when you're feeling depressed? Because I'm a cognitive therapist. CBT is the theory I use. So I believe that your belief systems are what drive your thoughts, and your thoughts drive your emotions, and emotions drive your behavior. So we can interrupt the thinking patterns that are negative and self-defeating, and we can give you a positive emotion. So let's say you believe I'm worthless. That's the deep-seated belief. So when you apply for a job, I'm not going to get this job. Why would I get this job? Nobody wants to hire me. I'm stupid. So you labeled yourself and you told the future. So when you feel that way, over the next week, write it down. Give me a time and a day and a situation, and then we can talk about it in our session. Again, this is just initial. We're just getting you used to listening to what you're thinking, and then as time goes on, we eventually want you to, okay, so let's replace that thought. What can you say instead? I feel, you're thinking, not feeling. You're feeling, not thinking. What do you think? I think that I'm not smart. Break down with it. Where does that come from? So as a counselor, we're just digging up what's already there, reflecting it, and hopefully that person kind of gets the awareness that the way I'm thinking is not helping me. It's not necessarily reality. Because what I tell my depressed clients all the time is that, you know, a person who's depressed is usually somebody who's very realistic. But sometimes they take their realism too far, and they can only see the negative. But if you can use that strength of being realistic to your advantage and seeing the whole picture, then you'll probably be less likely to have those depressed feelings, because you can find the hope in that. You can find the darkness, you can also find the light. So homework assignment would be track your thoughts, and then let's talk about it.
Okay. How likely is it that the symptoms will return in the future? And what can be done to help prevent that from happening?
Unfortunately, it depends on the triggers. It depends on what the person's actually diagnosed with, because depression is not the only diagnosis that has suicidal ideation. You know, bipolar disorder is depression mixed with manic episodes, which is basically intense or elevated emotion. So that could be really, really happy too, or right, really, really angry. And when you have that combination of someone who has depressed swings with really intense elevated emotion, they actually have a higher likelihood of attempting and completing suicide, because remember, depression makes you tired. So you may have the thoughts for a long time, but you don't really have the strength to do it. Somebody who's bipolar, yeah, the depression swing goes up, the thoughts are still there, they have the energy. That combination can lead to completion of suicide. So we're very, very careful and very cautious when it comes to bipolar patients. So again, the likelihood of return just depends on the diagnosis, also the person's triggers. Okay, so you were abused for most of your childhood, you grow up, you become an adult, you become a successful adult, but those feelings of you being that abused child come back. You deal with that in counseling, you haven't seen your family in years, you go to the family reunion, everything comes back again. You might have forgotten some of your skills, some of your new thinking patterns. You may have some type of, not relapse, but setback. So it just depends on the trigger. If there's like a stressful event or a traumatic event that happens that's usually related to the prior trauma, or just the thing that makes you feel the worst about yourself comes back. Or the bad relationship, domestic violence, that's another one. You know, you date someone or you're in a marriage with someone and you try to get yourself back out there and it happens again, you find another person. You know, anything that is your trigger, so that's why awareness is so important. When am I in a situation that reminds me of what I don't like? How do I get out of it before it, you know, hurts me? So the likelihood is hard to really track. It's more of an individual thing. If there's no real resolution, if the person doesn't get treatment, well then yeah, it's very likely that the suicide ideation comes back. In my inpatient work, you know, we have frequent flyers. We have kids that will come back. A lot of those kids are in foster care or the CPS system, where they're not in a stable home. They don't have their own parents, or their parents are really not doing what they're supposed to do, so they can't be back with them. They act out to get out of that situation. Could be truly suicidal, could be faking it, just depends. That's very rare though. Usually, you know, any kind of sign that someone feels hopeless or they don't want to live anymore, nobody really fakes that. There's some truth to it. So, anyway, to answer your question, it really depends on the individual, but triggers are usually the thing that are gonna cause someone to have those feelings again. But hopefully they have a plan in place to get out of that crisis and get back to a more stable place.
Okay. Are there any alternative treatments, for example, special diet, a massage therapy, biofeedback, vitamins, minerals, yoga, exercise programs, let's say, for example, a banana a day keeps the doctor away. I don't know. Apple, banana, grapes.
Local tattoo can lead to some medical issues. But those are all great suggestions of self-care activities. That was something I was going to mention as far as what to do to maintain once you are out of that dark place. Is you got to have a life. You have to give yourself something worth living for. And not just for other people. Something that really fulfills you, because you're the only you have. And so, you know, physical activities, social outlets. A lot of people, well, I don't like people. Well, that's what therapy's for. Let's figure out, why don't you like people? And, you know, think of me as a non-person. I am not in your life. I'm somebody hovering around your life.
You know, I saw that on someone's social media. I like to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
So, and don't ask me.
Isolation is another symptom, yeah. Okay. Where you are forcibly isolating yourself. It's a symptom in a lot of, because human beings are hardwired to be social. I'm not saying we need people around us 24/7. I'm not saying the introverts aren't real. I'm actually an introvert. I didn't figure this out until I was 24 in my counseling class. Like, wait a minute. People do make me tired. Sometimes I need to be by myself. You know, because extroversion just means you get energized, yeah. And introversion just means you get drained. And it is what it is. We all need ways to recharge. But to not have any people anywhere in your life is not a safe place to be. Being a hermit, as my older sister would say. She's like, if I knew what a hermit was, and they had a female version, that's what I would do. I'm just like, whatever, you love me. You love people. Just stop. But you want to have a couple of good friends or family members that you can lean on and just spend time with. Have people that you have common interests with. The internet's okay for that. It's a good way. It's a good first step to, like, find people to be around. Just talking to people online is not enough either.
Right.
Like, you need physical contact with people. You need to see their body language. You hear their voice. That kind of thing.
So when family and friends ask how they can help, you know, with the recovery, what things would you suggest?
I wrote this one down because it's really, family is important, but sometimes family can hold someone back. And let me explain why. Especially people with chronic mental illness, with more severe mental illness, they do a lot better in community settings. Like, they go to, like, you know, an apartment complex that has some people that have similar illness issues, or they stay with a foster family or something like that. You know, because number one, the people don't really know their history like family does.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, you know, we say judge not, we be judged, you know, in the Christian church, but people are judgmental. And family are judgmental because, hey, you're a reflection of me, you're my blood. But what I can say to family is, hold that person accountable without judgment. How do you do that? Well, did you say you were going to work out more? Don't you hear the judgmentalness in my tone versus, hey, what time is your yoga class this week? Just a question. They can say, oh, it's at 7 on Thursday. Okay. Hey, I want to go with you. Supporting that person. You know, just inviting yourself into their life. Because sometimes, you, again, they're going to push you away.
Oh, but not in a pushy way. Because you know you can have those family members be all up in your...
Well, girl, I'm going with you. No. Hey, I was thinking about going too.
Okay.
They just have to outright reject you. Like, now I want you there. I like my teacher. Okay. What does a teacher teach at another time? I might want to get my yoga on. Keeping it light. Like, just treating them like a normal person. Because they are a normal person.
Right.
You know, mental health is health. It's related to the body. Everybody has mental health. Is it a condition or not? That's what makes someone with a diagnosis different than somebody without.
Okay.
So, and I was going to mention, like, that community feel. You know, I was listening to another podcast, actually, and they interviewed the city in Europe where, like, people, you know, they have psychiatrists, but they live with families, and that's just their treatment. They don't necessarily see a therapist every week or something like that. And they've had some pretty good outcomes, but again, that's a country where there's homogeny, everybody looks the same, they don't have the same social history, so I'm not sure that could really work in America per se, but there is a place in New York where, you know, the apartment complex is, you know, half people without diagnosis and half people with diagnosis, and the people that sign up, they're all homeless, though. They're on the same economic spectrum, so it's like, okay, you don't know where to live, why am I going to judge this person? Whatever, as long as they don't come at me, we're good. And
right.
They build great communities, and those people have great outcomes when it comes to recovering from their illness. So, and also, knowing that person's warning sign. Well, when their mood's changing, what do they do? Are they, you know, are you seeing their lunches and dinners, how I get their appetite and their sleep? Those are the two main physical things that anybody can check for someone's mood changing. Are they staying up too much, or are they not sleeping, you know, or are they sleeping too little, too much? Are they eating too little, too much? Knowing your family member helps, but if it's like, they've been up till 3-4 days in a row, that's not good. That's a sign. And it's like, hey, I mean, how's sleeping all right? I mean,
okay.
Just a question. Child is so important. Accountable without judgment. Right?
So it's important to, you know, ask those questions without being judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
You need a certain tone, because sometimes a tone can be like, oh, no, she didn't try to judge me.
Mm-hmm.
She'd be more of a softer tone, but then not too soft, because you know you got some family members, like,
mm-hmm.
She's trying to be sarcastic. It's like, damn if you do, damn if you don't.
Right. Which is why I have a job, because I'm trained to have neutral or more positive tone, and I was not born with tact. It is something that I learned.
Okay.
Which is, you know, I know how to be honest without cutting people anymore.
Okay.
And again, I'm not perfect. I've definitely had to learn it. But I guess making statements and making questions about, again, things that the person's already said. Not questioning the person, but questioning their behavior.
Okay.
So, you know, what time did you say you were trying to get to bed tonight? Just a general question.
Okay.
Oh, I'm trying to go to bed around 10. Okay, it's 2 in the morning, you're still up. Hey man, what's going on? You all right? Like, it's 2 o'clock.
Right.
Oh, you know, and usually somebody who's just staying up is gonna give you some kind of narrative of why they're up that late. Somebody who's depressed, you probably won't get anything. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, if you know the person, it just depends on that individual. It's gonna take practice and being accountable to them. Just say, hey, you know, if I sound like I'm trying to judge you, please let me know, because you know I'm new to this. You know, I keep it real, whatever, you know, how people like to use that as an excuse. As Dave Chappelle has taught us, keeping it real does go wrong. So learn how to just be open with that person. And also a code word is good too. Because sometimes someone just wants to say, I feel depressed today. Especially people with COVID. We don't want to say that. We don't admit it.
Right.
When we admit it, we take it back. Well, nah, I'm just having a bad day. Something like, how about them Cowboys?
Okay.
And that could be their code for, I am feeling really bleak, bleak, bleak today.
Okay.
I don't know what to do. A hug, holding somebody's hand. Sometimes just being there with that person in that moment is enough for them to pick themselves up. So, again, these things need to be discussed beforehand. You have to have a plan.
Okay.
Because you fail to plan, you plan to fail.
Okay.
And, you know, suicide and depression doesn't just pop up overnight. It has to happen within a 2-week period based on what you're diagnosed. So,
Watch
it. Just pay attention without being don't have to be a super spy. You don't have to be stalking their internet. And let me see your phone. Like, especially with kids. Like, I know parents do this. Like, that's a whole other topic. But yeah, so be accountable. Hold them accountable without being judgmental. Know their warning signs, check their sleep and eating patterns, and, you know, have a code word, have an understanding that, hey, I'm one of your safe people,
okay.
So, you know, when I come at you, don't put the wall down because you asked me to do this for you. Because a lot of times, you know, when you're in treatment, we ask them, who are your safe people? Who are you going to call when you can't talk to your therapist? Or you can't talk to, you know, you don't want to call the police because it's not that bad. Like, you don't want the police coming up in your house and dragging you to the hospital because they do that.
They do that. Okay. Is there a video, book, or any other printed literature that contains useful information about, you know, many symptoms and recovery plans?
Yes, printed books, the best ones are going to be the ones that are like textbooks, like things for professionals. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you got a lot of jargon, you got a lot of extra information and quotations of people's studies, and it's kind of boring and just dry to read. Everything books, like everything about depression, everything about sleep, like those books are good because they're easy to read. If you just have a certain topic you want to look up, like, okay, well, how do I get my sleep back on track? Flip to the page on sleep. Same for the Four Dummies book. I know you might feel dumb by the Four Dummies book, but they work. They're really good books. If you just want quick information that you can just refer to over time. Now, there's lots of novels and things just to kind of make you not feel so isolated. Like, I'm the only person going through this. A lot of people's biographies are great. As far as recovery plans and things like that, I mean, you can Google that real quick. There's plenty of counseling resources out there. But again, I would strongly suggest you at least consulting with a professional, because the wording may seem regular, but there's a lot of thought that goes into those forms. And so you just want to consult with someone who has an outside perspective that doesn't know you, but knows how these things typically go, if you really are in a place where you need a recovery.
So are there, for your lifestyle, are there any changes that, you know, that can speed up your recovery?
Consistency is a behavior. So whatever you plan to do, do it. Sticking to a routine, not so stringent that you don't have any room for fun. If you have to schedule fun. If you have to make yourself have fun, because depression, again, takes away your will to. Fake it till you make it. It works. It is okay. Something that, okay, you know, I don't know how we word it, and there's a fancy way to say it, but it's fake it till you make it. But it's not like a cold where, you know, once the symptoms are gone, I stop taking the medicine. But mental health, the treatment is ongoing. You never stop treating yourself. Just, again, somebody without a diagnosis, you exercise every three times a week to stay healthy. That's just what you do. Like, you don't stop exercising, because if you do, you have adverse effects. You go backwards. You don't keep the goals that you had. So depending on what type of therapy you just choose to get, like I was mentioning earlier, homework, keeping every we love handouts. We like teachers in that way, counselors. So keep all those handouts, any informational sheets. Have a little binder of like my resources to refer back to. Like, if you end up going to a hospital, like, don't look at that as, that's like a diabetic going to the hospital. It's gonna happen eventually if you have a diagnosis. But they give you a lot of handouts, and I work with kids, so they ball them up, they turn them into, you know, airplanes. But there's with children, and we also give them resources to take anyway. But for adults, like, keep the stuff that people give you, because we're not giving it to you just because we have to. We give it to you because it's helpful. And in the, you know, as you are starting your recovery, you want to have something to refer to. So tracking yourself, having, you know, we all have cell phones, there's calendars, there's checklists, to-do lists, you know, finding a way to hold yourself accountable. I'm an undiagnosed ADHD person. I made it through school because I liked school, so I never really got in trouble, but I got in trouble.
Okay.
It's like, we don't sit Tiffany outside by herself since she finished her work and she's talking to everybody and making, you know, a scene in the classroom. And it, you know, so go over there, Tiffany. So I got away with it. But most kids nowadays, especially those with ADHD and, you know, emotional disturbances, they're isolated. They don't really have support in school and stuff like that. So it's like learning how to, because I was smart, people gave me more attention, but that's not fair. Like, right, most kids are smart too. Just nobody's tapped into that. So tracking what the person's doing, watching yourself, teaching yourself how to be accountable to yourself. Like, right, that's the only thing I can say about lifestyle changes, is making yourself a priority.
So accountability is very important.
So important.
I think accountability is important if you're not suicidal.
Right. It's a good citizenship skill. Right?
Let's be accountable.
Yeah.
Okay. Question. So why do some people die by suicide?
Okay. The two things we always look for is means and intent.
Okay.
we have, you know, suicide ideation is, I want to kill myself, and this is how I'm going to do it. You can do, you usually can't have means, you can have means and no intent. That's what, you know, people that are gun-owning people, they have the means for suicide, but they don't have any intent. They don't want to kill themselves. And you have people that want to kill themselves, I don't know, I just want to die. We hear that all the time. So that's like a passive intent. You don't really have a plan. You're still in the danger zone, but we're not, like, we would need to hospitalize you for that. Okay, we're going to refer you to a therapist. Talk about these feelings. Let's get you to a better place. And like I was mentioning earlier about different disorders that can be more risky. I mentioned bipolar. Schizophrenia is also another disorder that has a high suicide rate because think about like paranoia. They're fearful. They believe a lot of their delusions, the things they believe that are not true, like the government's out to get them. You know,
so I have a question. So, LA, one of his dearest friends, his best friend, she committed suicide in December.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. So, do you think that could have been a reason why he did?
Yes. I can't remember what the phenomenon is called. Any name that I'm thinking of right now doesn't seem appropriate or politically correct, so I won't say that. But suicide doesn't breed other suicides, but it's a permanent solution for temporary problems a lot of times. And so whatever grief he was experiencing from losing his friend probably wasn't processed. Hopelessness. You have depression and then you see someone get out. It's a freedom. It's a release in the mind of the person that is suffering.
Because she committed suicide, and when she did it, she used a gun, like he used
legal,
a gun.
Legal means.
Illegal means. Mm-hmm. And then also, prior to that, she wrote him a letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he got the letter after she committed suicide. So, evidently, it was planned.
Yeah.
So, do you think that he tried, that he, well, he did.
Feel he felt guilty.
He felt guilty.
And guilt is another, excessive or inappropriate guilt is another symptom of depression. So, again, if he was already depressed and then this happened, now he has an actual reason to feel guilty, even though he doesn't really have a reason to feel guilty.
Because I'm asking these questions because he used to cut himself.
Okay, so he was
a cutter when he was 13.
Okay.
So him being a cutter in 13, and then, you know, he would tell me he's going to counseling. He never wanted to detail why he was going to counseling.
Okay.
But he would say, oh, Nayette, I'm going to counseling. I said, well, have fun counseling, honey.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
At least he was going to counseling.
Yeah.
So I don't know, with his friend committing suicide, was that his breaking point?
It could have been. It could have been. And just, it's so hard to say because he can't speak for himself or what he was going through. I mean, yeah. Yes and no. You know, again, it's the extent or the depth, the severity, that's what I mean, of his depression, coupled with grief, which is the depression that everyone experiences at some point in their life, we all grieve, and it puts you in the same place as depression does a lot of times, and just maybe a shorter time span. On top of having the means, was he a licensed gun owner? Did he get a gun illegally?
See, I don't know all that.
Like, he's male, so that puts him at a higher risk, because I know that was something that people ask. Well, men are more likely to commit suicide. Black men have a 9% rate and to the general pop, which is 16. So we have a pretty high rate. It's pretty close to what happens in all the country, in the country with all the races. But guns are the number one way people kill themselves. Again, it's quick, it's lethal, and the access is way too easy. Not to politicize it, but it's the easiest way. I would agree with you that losing his friend, having the history, I was like the list of things, you know, having a history of mental health conditions, having, being male, men are more impulsive naturally, not naturally, I'm not gonna say that, but testosterone does increase impulsivity in men have testosterone, that's what I mean, not in a gender sexism type of thing. And then the history of self-harm is definitely associating pain with release. That's kind of what self-harm does for a person that does it. It's like, I can't express my pain any other way but by hurting myself.
So what would be the most common signs? Like the most, yeah, the most kind of warning signs?
Mood change, hopelessness, and if they do anything drastic, like purchasing a weapon. Like if they just all of a sudden are a gun owner. Not that they go to the CDL class and do all that stuff, but, oh, I got a gun. What's a gun show? Because you don't have to do that if you go to a gun show.
Because him purchasing the gun, I didn't know. His mom probably didn't know. No one probably knew. Mm-hmm. So what would be another warning sign that you could see?
Did he give things away before?
I don't think he did.
Was he on a medication at all?
He was on a medication.
And because you didn't live with him, so you don't know if he was taking it every day.
Yeah.
Sometimes people stockpile medication and try to overdose, which is the most common way people fail, thank goodness.
But
then they try to overdose and then they end up in the hospital.
But then I was reading also with women have a more higher rate of overdose than men actually committing mm-hmm. the act successfully.
Right, exactly. Women use more non-lethal means.
Why is that?
Well, access for one. I mean, you know, guns and masculinity are kind of associated in our culture. So, you know, a woman going to get a gun is going to raise eyebrows versus a guy going to get a gun. And also, women have more ideation that's recorded. So women are going to be more likely to use their social circle to kind of give the signs. And we're more social based on just how our lifestyles are set up. You know, usually we have some type of duty or relationship that we're responsible for. So people are going to see those changes more likely, or they're going to talk about it more likely. Versus a male who's going to probably internalize a lot of those feelings. Our culture doesn't really support men talking about feelings in general. Internalize, plan, and then go through it. We tell boys, you know, just do it, you know, go for it. And those kind of belief systems, like I was talking about earlier, deep-seated beliefs are going to encourage a more drastic and lethal way of trying to lose someone's life versus, you know, what is acceptable for women.
Okay. How many people know about the warning signs and how to detect if a person is going to attempt suicide?
Well, that's something I haven't really looked into, but that sounds like a research study that needs to be done if it hasn't been done. I'm really big on social and mental health stigma and understanding what it looks like and how we can decrease it. And so that would be one of those questions I would want to know. Like, what do you know about mental health? What do you know about the warning signs? Because, I mean, the CDC and the National SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Association, all those government organizations, they do all this research, they gather this data, they throw it on the internet, and that's all you hear about. So it's not really common knowledge. You know, kids are going to learn about this in their social studies class, and, you know, adults, I mean, you pick a job, you go to work. Unless you work in psychology, you really don't have any interaction with this kind of information. So I don't think many people know about the warning signs. I mean, they don't even know who the Supreme Court justices are, so why would they know, you know, mood swings and if somebody randomly buys a gun and gives you their favorite thing, then I need to be worried.
Yeah, that is true.
Right, so I don't have any numbers, but I would think the number is less than half of people.
Okay. What are the common myths about suicide?
Crazy people do it.
Huh.
That's common. Crazy to me, this is what I tell all my clients, crazy is just doing the unexpected, which is how we can use it in slang. You do something unexpected, girl, that's crazy, or you cray. Mm. If you can put unexpected in there, then that's probably what you mean, not crazy. Not everybody has diagnosed depression, but again, anybody can have depression. I mean, half of us in our lifetime are going to have something that can be clinically diagnosed. You might not get it diagnosed, but if you look back and check off those symptoms, you only need 7.
Hmm.
It's 13, so it's very easy to, fall into depression. Another common myth is that hard for me to look at the myths because I know the truth. I guess something else someone would think about someone commit suicide is that, you know, well, it's their own fault. Well, yeah, it's a selfish act. I would agree. And it's a permanent solution for typically temporary problems. But again, it's all those factors we were talking about earlier, you know, how boys are socialized in our country, our culture around guns. That's a social issue. That's a bigger level issue. And even, I remember we were talking earlier about, you know, class. You know, class is not an issue with it. And It's not just poor people killing themselves, but that's a common myth. Mm-hmm. And it's not just men. Women do commit, or it's not just women. I don't think people think about men committing suicide as often as they do. We can't even think about, I don't even know what the statistics are, but there are a lot of men that will die by gunfire and will want the police to kill them. And I know it's kind of an interesting dynamic to think about when we talk about, you know, black men being killed in this country by a lot of armed forces, but also white men, Latino, Asian, I mean, of all races, that will, you know, make a scene, act. A lot of the people that are killed, shot by police, are people with mental health problems. And sometimes that can be planned, sometimes it can be accidental, but regardless, people don't really think about men killing themselves because it's kind of seen as a cowardly act when really it's, excuse me, a permanent solution for a temporary problem. And it's not just the individual's issue, it is a social issue. It's the second leading cause of death for kids, for people 15 to 24. Number one is
like car accidents. Oh, wow. If someone suspects that a friend or family member is considering suicide, what should they do?
I mean,
how many steps are there?
How many steps? Let's see. One, talk to the person.
Okay.
Two, do they have means? Do they have intent? That's what you were going to ask them. Do they have means? So, do you want to kill yourself? You can ask the person directly. People think that you ask the right question, it's going to make them want to do it. If they are already thinking about it, they're already thinking about it. They either don't give you a yes or no. They give you an I don't know. Well, if you could, what would you do? And I know it sounds scary, but if you get a clear answer and they have that, those means, well, I want to hang myself. Okay, well, you need to call the police or call or ask their parent if they're an adult, I mean a child, to, you know, you need to go talk to someone. And you might have to hold their hand, they might have to be kicking and screaming. The more they resist, the more likely they're going to end up in inpatient care. So I would suggest, you know, hey, this is, I'm afraid for you. I mean, I know you're going to be mad at me, but I'd rather you be mad at me on this side of the world than the other side.
Okay.
So, again, I think about kids all the time, that's what I work with. But again, if this is another adult, it's a lot more complicated because they have rights. They can say no, they can consent or not consent. But if you have real fears, like this person has a gun in this house, they have several guns, so they're gonna kill themselves, you know, I would at least like a peace officer to come over and, you know, try to help me convince them to go willingly. But sometimes it doesn't go that easy. It's not an easy thing.
Step three.
So get those. So, okay, first step was talk to them, intent and means. Step three would be find resources. So whether it's a suicide hotline, and you can have them talk to someone who's a, you know, counselor, or calling the local hospital, and they can talk to someone on the phone, like a counselor or an intake counselor, to see if it would be a good idea for them to be inpatient. If not, you know, it's a crisis, so you have to do something. Don't just leave them by themselves. You gotta sit there and lay with them all night and watch them. I mean, make that sacrifice for your friend, because leaving that person alone is the last thing you need.
Is your step four?
Step four, follow up.
Okay.
Okay, so if they go to the hospital, and again, with adults, it's a little different. They have to get consent to call you. They have to, you know, you can't just call to the hospital. I need to talk to my homie. You need their medical numbers. You need their birthday. You need consent from them. So they have to want to talk to you. So again, they may be mad. That doesn't mean you don't talk to their family or their significant other. Like, just stay involved, but not too involved, because you're going to hit a lot of walls, because people have rights. Once they're patients, we protect them on their time, you know, and their privacy is really important. Don't start posting stuff on the internet. Don't start, like, you know, making memes and, you know, making gifs about their struggle and their strife. You know, get involved in some type of organization if that person just shuts you out. If you help save their life, you've done more than enough. But try your best to stay involved and follow up with them, and, you know, write them a letter or whatever you need to do to just let them know that I did this out of the goodness of my heart, not to embarrass you, not to shame you, and I did it because, you know, I care for you, I love you, if that's the sentiment. Imminent, if it's not imminent, follow up. Like, hey, you having a good day? Just, you know, send them a funny video, something, just to show that person that I don't see you differently. I still see you as a person that I care about. But, you know, I'm going to be here whether you want me here or not, because I care about you. I don't want you to find a permanent solution for a temporary problem. So,
Tiffany, how can schools and communities work together to prevent suicide?
They can lot. They're an important part of somebody's development is having places for people to go and do things that are beneficial. And there's actually so many things that are already in our community that people don't access. I mean, recreation centers and clubs and all kinds of things that people can do. But also making people know that you're a safe space and having connections to professionals, like having relationships with organizations so that, okay, so I go to the rec and I play basketball and, you know, I'm at the front office and I just need to know, I just want to talk to somebody. Usually, you know, they have a list, this little resource list, hand it out, have it out so people can put their number down and do things on their own without feeling like they're being exposed. Because, you know, shame is a huge part of mental health. And the stigma, you know, people are ashamed because shame tells us we're bad. And you're not bad for having problems. You're human for having problems. And so, but you have to learn that. Again, that's a deep-seated belief that not being perfect makes us bad. But in reality, nobody's perfect. We know this, but we don't know this for some reason. So, you know, communities can make themselves more accessible, you know. Marketing is a great thing. You know, if I didn't know that there were yoga classes in my recreation center, well, how am I supposed to know? I have to go do all the work. Sometimes communities have to meet us halfway. So just putting yourself out there, whether you have a small little community group that you do or something that you do that will benefit a lot of people, just having some type of self-care. Maybe it's not normal for me to flip the lights on 15 times. Obsessive compulsive,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's not normal.
It's not normal, but it's not typical. We'll say typical.
Okay.
It's not typical, but it doesn't mean you can't get help for it. And then as far as schools, they're supposed to have those structures in place. And unfortunately, due to the testing push, like the school counselors don't really get to do as much counseling as they used to. And so, again, having those relationships with organizations where they can refer out so that parents can find something for their kid, and a lot of organizations who go in the home, a lot of counselors. I mean, I'm an in-home counselor. I work with foster kids. We'll drive our little happy bus to your house and bring our toys and bring all of our stuff and work with the kid where they are, because that's our job, is to meet the person where they are. But knowledge is power. It's just like getting that information out there is so hard. So a show like yours is a great, great thing. I'm really honored to, you know, be asked to do this. But, you know, explore. You got the internet in your pocket. Just Google some stuff, man. It's not that hard. Like, and that's the only thing I get frustrated with. Well, I don't know what to do with my teenagers. I'm sorry, let me see your phone. What do you like doing? Right there. Like, you want walking directions? We can walk right there. And I like to use humor. Like, just because it's life. Like, there's no need to be somber and sad about it, but that's another good sign that you're coming out of it, that you can laugh again, man. You can laugh at yourself, laugh at other people, at the absurdity of life. Because, we're not here that long, so you don't want to, you know, give up before you've really seen what could be possible.
Well, Tiffany, I want to say thank you so very much. This is Tiffany Lindley with The Help Show. If you want to contact Tiffany, you can contact her at tiffany.linley, that's tiffany.linley @gmail.com. Or also, you can follow her on Twitter at magtiffi.cent. And what's that?
Magtificent.
Hey, Magtificent. Thank you so much, Tiffany.
Thank you.
For more information, visit us on our website
at thehelpshow.com. Thank you for listening, and please stay tuned.
Did you enjoy The Help Show? Well, visit us at thehelpshow.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and my favorite, Periscope.
That is my favorite. I love Periscope.
Join us on The Help Show for next month's topic on drug addiction.